this is a bridge too far. We don't want Nazis in our city council, which seems like kind of a low bar.
Yeah, it does. Maybe not as low of a bar as it used to be in this country, but, you know.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Totally anti-Nazi here.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Just to be clear.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York on WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe for you every day on the internets. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, and Detour Talk. Not to mention most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell anti-Nazi guy from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, I am glad to say we are proudly anti-Nazi here.
Oh, now you're getting in on the anti-Nazi regime, are you? Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Good to have you here, and good to have all of you here with us today. Before we get to somewhat grimmer news from today, from Tuesday's elections around the country in New York and Connecticut, Rhode Island, and notably in Wisconsin, all of which held less than surprising presidential elections, but where in Wisconsin there were some other things of note on Tuesday's ballot, which we will get to with a guest momentarily. Here's an encouraging reminder of how democracy is supposed to work, even, yes, in what is considered to be deep red, the deep red state of Oklahoma. As reported by NBC News last night, voters in Enid, Oklahoma, decided by a nearly 20-point margin on Tuesday to remove a city council member over his ties to white nationalist groups. Judd Blevins lost his seat on Enid's six-member city council by 268 votes, according to unofficial results from the Oklahoma State Election Board. That was actually a pretty huge margin in this small community. Nearly 1,400 people turned out for Tuesday's recall election, which was hundreds more than those who voted for the original election when Blevins was first elected last year. Blevins will now be replaced by Cheryl Patterson, a former teacher and longtime Republican who campaigned on a return to, quote, normalcy for this small city nearly 100 miles north of Oklahoma City. Normalcy. The city has been divided in recent months over the furor over Blevins, quote, "We won," said Connie Vickers, a Democrat in the otherwise conservative town of Enid, who was among the first to publicly confront Blevins over his white nationalist ties. "Blevins lost. Hate lost," she said. Blevins faced the recall vote after local activists learned that he had marched alongside neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, Virginia, back in 2017, and led an Oklahoma chapter of the white nationalist group Identity Europa. Blevins has denied that he has ever been a white supremacist, but at a candidate forum just last week, he defended marching in Charlottesville and said his activism was motivated by, quote, the same issues that got Donald Trump elected in 2016.
The same issues that got Donald Trump elected in 2016, securing America's borders, reforming our legal immigration system, and frankly, pushing back on this anti-white hatred that is so common in media and entertainment.
Yeah, there you go. This anti-white hatred.
Yeah, that's what it is. Sure.
In media and entertainment. No, that's not a centuries old anti-Jewish trope or anything.
But I'm not going to play this game where I take things that the media says are problems from America's past that are no longer problems today and pretend like they're serious issues. They're not.
They're not. They're not serious. They're all issues in the past. What are you talking about? Slavery,
yes.
Racism. We're done with that.
Says the former white supremacist.
Former? Are you
Maybe
sure?
Maybe former, yeah, we're not sure.
Right. On Election Day, Patterson, his opponent in the recall, and a group of supporters held campaign signs on a busy corner. Patterson said she was looking forward to, quote, a resounding message that Enid is a great place to be. She added, Enid is not a town that promotes white nationalism or white supremacy in any way, and the people are good. And I'm hoping that the results of the election will show that, she said. And it appears those results did. NBC continues, as voters trickled into polling stations on Tuesday, many said they didn't vote in that race originally and had no idea back then that Blevins, a former Marine who now works for his family's roofing business, had been active in white national groups. Nearly everyone that NBC's Brandi Zadrozny spoke to at the polls on Tuesday said they didn't want their city to be known as a place that tolerates hate. Quote, it does matter what you've done, who you've associated with, said Paul Martin, a cattle farmer and Democrat who said he votes for candidates regardless of party and learned of Blevins' white nationalist ties only after his original election. The evidence of his Blevins' activism with these Nazi groups was out there, however. In 2019, he had been outed by anti-fascist researchers and the progressive media outlet Right Wing Watch. The articles included photos of Blevins back in 2017 marching alongside the tiki torch wielding neo-Nazis at the rally in Charlottesville and the next day at the Unite the Right rally at an event where counter-protesters were beaten and a woman was murdered. They included screenshots of his posts on the internets, racist and anti-Semitic writings praising Hitler, for example, in secret forums and chats where Blevins identified himself under the pseudonym Conway as the Oklahoma State coordinator for Identity Europa, one of the movement's largest and most active white nationalist groups. But those articles, which named Blevins as Judson Blevins, do not appear when you Google Judd Blevins, apparently. And Judd is how he's known in Enid. 5 weeks before Election Day last year, however, the local paper, the Enid News and Eagle, did publish a front-page story headlined City Candidate Accused of White Nationalist Ties. Blevins, however, called that article fake news. It wasn't. And he told supporters the, quote, George Soros-funded lefts attacking him in such a way only bolstered his bona fides as a conservative Republican. Does that sound familiar to anyone out there? He won his original race last year by just 36 votes, and the election shook Enid's progressive residents. In response, they formed the Enid Social Justice Committee, or ESJC, and they decided on their first mission would be to inform their neighbors of their new city council members' white nationalist ties. When it became clear that Blevins would neither explain nor apologize, the ESJC submitted the signatures that it had collected, and they filed the recall petition. In the recall election, Blevins attacked Patterson, his opponent, as a tool of ESJC. Even though many in the ESJC are progressive and Patterson is a conservative Republican, and that voting for the Republican candidate Patterson would be a vote for fringe groups of radicals. He compared himself to former President Donald Trump, besieged on all sides by far-left, quote, perverts, and a deep state within the city council in Enid.
Tiny Enid?
That went all the way up to the mayor. That would be conservative Republican Mayor David Mason, who happens to be a conservative Republican himself. But I guess he's a secret member of the deep state. He says he asked Blevins behind closed doors about being a member of those Nazi groups. And Blevins admitted that he was behind closed doors.
And my follow-up question was, are you still involved with those groups? And he told me I do not have to answer that question. And my thought was, you just did. If we vote him in a second time, it probably says a lot about who we are.
Yeah, it would have.
Yes, it would have.
Conservative Republican mayor of Enid, Oklahoma, David Mason. At a BYOB party on Tuesday night, thrown by the ESJC at a local tea house, the group erupted at 8:14 p.m., according to NBC, when the Oklahoma State Election Board's website projected on a big screen there showed that Blevins had been, in fact, defeated on Tuesday night. Christy Baldin, the chair of the group, said to claps and screams, "We did it." The lesson, she said, was that a small group anywhere could fight extremism. Quote, "You can do this because we did this," she said. "We didn't even know what we were doing, and we did this. This is possible," she said. It is possible. That is how democracy is supposed to work. Even in largely Republican areas, underscoring my point that that I often make, that my advocacy, at least this year, is not a matter of partisanship. It is a matter of right versus wrong. And in this year's election, it happens to be democracy versus autocracy. Or in Enid, Oklahoma on Tuesday, democracy versus extremism, or democracy versus right-wing fascism, or democracy versus white supremacy, or democracy versus Nazis. Take your pick. But that is what is actually on the ballot all across the country this year. So for all of the issues and all of the concerns that we have, and there are many of them, including concerns with the particular candidate, the president that's in the White House now and the candidate who will be on the ballot running against Donald Trump this year. With all of those problems, please keep in mind that this is about democracy versus extremism, democracy versus fascism, democracy, yes, versus white supremacy, and democracy versus Nazism, literally. So this is how democracy is supposed to work, at least when it has not been corrupted within an inch of its life, which is still the case when it comes to many small but critical elections in small towns and communities around the country that are not corrupted, at least not yet. I'd like to think it's still possible at the state and federal level to somehow clean up the corruption that we see and have a more perfect union, a more perfect democracy, working on it. But it's one of the reasons why I tell you that even in these primary races, you need to get out and vote because there's other things on the ballot. As we see in Wisconsin, which... you got a lot of work to do when it comes to perfecting democracy. And there's a lot of places where it feels like it's going one step forward and two steps back, including in places like Wisconsin.
Right. And in Oklahoma, where, I mean, as you have pointed out, it's super important to go ahead and vote in these primaries and special elections. It actually matters. Local elections, state elections. I mean, this guy in Enid, Oklahoma, yep. He was elected by just tens of voters. Every vote mattered.
Last year, 36 votes. Yeah. That's all it was.
And it mattered this time,
yep.
too. And so that's why I think when you help other people understand the impact of voting for your local officials and your state officials, because those people have a direct effect on your life.
And speaking of democracy taking two steps forward, or no, one step forward and two steps back. The great state of Wisconsin on Tuesday sadly seems to have taken two steps back. That on the heels of some recent victories in the Badger State following the election of a progressive majority on the state's Supreme Court, which subsequently ordered new legislative maps for the first time in more than a decade for the state's incredibly GOP gerrymandered state House and Senate, which after years of near supermajorities for Republicans could finally flip to Democratic control in both houses beginning with this November's elections. But on Tuesday, so that's the good news, but on Tuesday in Wisconsin, voters in the state approved two new constitutional amendments that were quietly placed on the ballot by its corrupted, gerrymandered, still gerrymandered Republican state legislature. Both of those measures could have a very serious effect on elections in the critical battleground state this November. And we will be joined more momentarily by one of the folks who tried to sound the alarm about those two measures several weeks ago. But first up, as to those presidential primaries in four states on Tuesday, of course, the winners on both the Democratic and Republican side are already foregone conclusions in the presidential primaries. Joe Biden swept all four states for his party, and Donald Trump swept all four of those same states for Republicans as well. But is there anything else that we can glean from the results as reported as of today? Well, for one, we can get some sense yet again of how popular each candidate and likely nominee is among their own party's voters on Tuesday, at least among those who turn out for primaries, and in this case, primaries where the results are already a foregone conclusion. In Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, and Wisconsin on Tuesday, Donald Trump won by a margin over other candidates and or the uncommitted line on the ballot where available by anywhere from 64 points to 74 points. In Rhode Island, he won by 74 points, and the other three states he won by margins in the mid to upper 60s. Joe Biden, on the other hand, who has faced a concerted effort by elements of the Democratic coalition to vote on the uncommitted line when possible, when it's available as a protest vote against the Biden administration's position on Israel's war against Gaza. Well, Joe Biden won by margins in those same four states on Tuesday by anywhere from 68 points in Rhode Island to 87 points in New York. In Connecticut, Biden won by 74 points and by 80 points in Wisconsin, where there was a specific drive to have Democrats cast votes for the line on the ballot in Wisconsin that is called uninstructed delegation. That is what other states generally call uncommitted in states that offer such an option on primary ballots. In fact, in Rhode Island and Connecticut, the uncommitted vote was actually higher than the uninstructed vote in Wisconsin on the Democratic side on Tuesday night. 15% voted uncommitted in Rhode Island, and 11% chose that option in Connecticut. At the same time, in every state but Rhode Island, Donald Trump had more of his own party's voters voting against him than Joe Biden saw from his own party's voters. Make of that what you will. Nikki Haley continued to get double-digit support in each of the four states.
That says a lot.
Along with uncommitted and even folks like Ron DeSantis and Chris Christie picked up 3 or 4% in some of those states. Haley got 11 points in Rhode Island, 14 in Connecticut, 13 points in New York, 13 in Wisconsin. Now, in Wisconsin, on the Democratic side, we should note that 48,000 voters voted for uninstructed delegation, or about 8% of the vote on Tuesday. Dean Phillips got 3% of the vote on Tuesday. But that's where there was a push specifically to vote for uninstructed as a protest vote against the Biden administration's handling of Israel's horrific and getting horrificer war on Gaza. 48,000 Democratic voters chose to send that message to Biden on Tuesday in a state where in 2020, Joe Biden won by fewer than 21,000 votes. So 48,000 Democratic voters voted against Biden on the uncommitted line after he won by just 21,000 votes a few years ago. 4 years earlier, Donald Trump carried that state by nearly 23,000 votes. So this might suggest that if even half of Tuesday's uninstructed voters, the uninstructed coalition, the people who voted for the uninstructed line, if just half of them either sits out the general election or they vote for a third party candidate, or if they even vote for Donald Trump for reasons that I could not begin to fathom, given Trump's election would be much, much worse for the people in Gaza. Well, if that happens, this year's race could be thrown into more flux than it already is. On the other hand, with most of the votes now counted, Donald Trump got just over 79% of the votes in his party in Wisconsin's GOP primary. Joe Biden got 89%. Donald Trump got 79%. So more than 76,000, or almost 13%, voted for Nikki Haley, who dropped out of the race weeks ago, and DeSantis, and uninstructed and even Chris Christie also got the votes of almost 50,000 Republicans combined. So added together, that's about 125,000 Badger State Republican primary voters who went to the polls on Tuesday and checked a box for someone, or I guess something, other than Donald Trump. So everything in perspective. What to make of all of that? Well, for today, we will just quote what Fox News used to say, what they used to pretend to mean. Now they don't even pretend it anymore, but we report, you decide. A far more disturbing result, I'm afraid, in Wisconsin is the fact that Wisconsin voters statewide easily approved two Republican-driven constitutional amendments, putting what could prove to be severe restrictions on civic participation in elections this year and the ability for local election officials to even run them and for voting rights and democracy advocates to assist voters in voting in them. With the adoption of these two new constitutional amendments in Wisconsin that will, the first one, put a ban on private funding in support of elections, and the second one placed new limits on who can perform election-related duties at all. Let's take a quick break, and we will come back as Alex Burness from Bolt Magazine joins us. He tried to sound the alarm on both of these constitutional measures several weeks ago. He will join us next to explain what they are and why they are so troubling. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to the broadcast. Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. Please help the broadcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the broadcast and bradblog.com free for all. We couldn't do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way. I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
On my way. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That is yes, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And that's the problem. A vote of yes. It's not the group yes is the problem, but a vote of yes in Wisconsin. Voters in Wisconsin on Tuesday pretty overwhelmingly voted yes on a pair of state constitutional amendments championed by Trump-allied Republicans in the state that will change campaign and election rules ahead of the critical November election in the narrowly divided battleground state. The first measure, known as Question 1 on Tuesday's ballot, will ban the use of private funds to aid in the state's administration of elections. That measure passed, according to unverified results reported today, by about 9 points. So that was adopted. The second measure, known as Question 2, stipulates that, quote, only election officials designated by law are allowed to perform election-related tasks. Republicans said they wanted to ensure that private consultants cannot engage in election administration. That constitutional amendment was reportedly adopted by an even larger 17-point margin. Both of those measures were initially passed as legislation by Wisconsin's GOP gerrymandered state legislature. It's heavily GOP gerrymandered state legislature. But they were vetoed by the state's Democratic governor, Tony Evers. So Republican lawmakers then pivoted to the ballot measure route, which cannot be vetoed by the governor. Now, if all of this sounds somewhat familiar, it may be because on yesterday's program, we discussed the ongoing attempt by the GOP-controlled state legislature in Arizona to radically change election laws in that state with a state constitutional amendment that would end early voting and vote by mail, among other popular things in the state, with a constitutional amendment, because if such a measure were to be passed, to be adopted as legislation, it would quickly be vetoed by that state's Democratic governor, Katie Hobbs. Arizona Republicans are hoping to place that measure on the ballot this November. But in the case of Wisconsin, this now seems to be a done deal. Both questions, to bar private funding of elections and the requirement that only duly sworn election officials may perform election-related functions, well, they both seem innocuous enough, at least on the surface, at least as they were described on Tuesday's ballot. Thus, the pretty overwhelming support for the two measures in an otherwise closely divided state. The two questions received little attention, however, from either the media or the two major parties in the state in advance of the election, and therefore, well, both passed easily on Tuesday. But not everyone in the media was standing down on the job on this. In a deep dive report several weeks ago at the independent Progressive Bolts magazine, journalist Alex Burness issued what might have amounted as a warning to Wisconsin voters and given the importance of the state's elections to the nation in presidential contests. Perhaps this was a warning to all of us, particularly when it came to Question 2, the new Badger State constitutional amendment that restricts who may assist with so-called election tasks. That, according to Burness, has election and voting advocates very concerned that it could both block out private contractors who play a critical role in functioning elections and could alienate various groups and volunteers who are needed to run the polls and to help voters to vote in Wisconsin. Question two, they worry, according to Burness, could, quote, call into question the legality of any number of actions that these volunteers and outside organizations routinely perform in aid of the nearly 2,000 county and municipal clerks who run Wisconsin's elections. Joining us now is Alex Burness, a staff reporter at Bolts and a veteran journalist who focuses on voting rights and the justice system. Alex Burness, welcome back to the Bradcast, sir. Excellent work in this Bolts piece, and thank you for joining us on the show today.
I appreciate it, and thanks for having me on.
So these measures were sort of quietly added to Tuesday's presidential primary ballot by the GOP legislature, and in addition to receiving little explanation of the potential dangers I think, by the mainstream media. There was also no real organized institutional opposition from Democrats or voting rights advocates. Nonetheless, as you report, these measures could have a chilling effect and perhaps even result in chaos in this November's critical elections in Wisconsin, particularly that second question. But let's focus for a moment on the first one that was adopted on Tuesday, where the text on the ballot asked if an amendment to the state constitution shall be, quote, created to provide that private donations and grants may not be applied for, accepted, expended, or used in connection with the conduct of any primary, election, or referendum. Well, it sounds like a reasonable enough thing, Alex. You know, we shouldn't have outside people or groups able to fund and or therefore buy public elections, right? But what is this measure really about, and why did Republicans feel it necessary to put this amendment before voters on Tuesday?
This measure is really about long tail outrage over hundreds of millions of dollars that Mark Zuckerberg and his wife donated to aid in local election administration during the 2020 cycle, when local administrators all around the country were facing unprecedented challenges related to running a presidential election during a health emergency. Mm-hmm. There have been plenty of people who have checked and plenty of lawsuits on this, and there's really no evidence that that money went to aid liberal areas or to specifically boost turnout among Democratic voters or to suppress it among Republican voters. But that has not stopped mm-hmm. Republicans around the country from passing laws to ban anything like that happening in the future. Now, the reason that that money was donated, yes, it was a public health emergency, but these offices, even in better times, are chronically underfunded, are chronically understaffed in many, many cases. And election officials I've talked to around the country in red states, blue states, and swing states like Wisconsin mm-hmm. say that they really needed that money. That they needed the resources and that they were overwhelmed in 2020. And even though things have cooled off substantially on the COVID front, many of those themes remain today. So Wisconsin Republicans mm-hmm. have taken the step of placing on the ballot a measure to say no more of this outside money. You mentioned it. It can sound innocuous. It yeah. sounds good. You're a low information, medium information voter. I mean, who wants somebody from the outside coming in and buying election administration? That's a sacred operation. And I get it. I understand how that sounds so good. The problem is it cuts off funding that these offices really need, and that in many cases they're not getting from their states. So Wisconsin Democrats, who unanimously opposed the placement of this measure on the ballot, said during public debate on this, you can't have it both ways. You can't ban the outside money coming in to help these folks while also not providing that money yourself. But Wisconsin Republicans have these majorities in the legislature. They placed it on the ballot. Since it sounds so good, not many people just might agree with it anyway, even if they aren't low information voters. But I think it's no surprise that it's passed. Wisconsin's now the 28th state to do it. So not exactly groundbreaking that it happened there.
And is this I'm wondering just how critical this funding is. Obviously, during the pandemic, you know, all sorts of measures were taken that, you know, cost money that were not taken for normal elections. Is the idea of outside money given to these, you know, small jurisdictions, is that something that was done prior to the pandemic? Is it something that will be missed now that the pandemic, in theory, is over?
I'm not aware of that being done at any scale like that. Mm-hmm. I think it is something that is going to be missed this year if it doesn't happen in states where election officials are complaining about a lack of resources. It's sort of hard to quantify what exactly the damage is going to be. But if you can't afford to pay poll workers, if you can't afford to recruit poll workers, if you can't afford those extra drop boxes or those more modern voting machines or tabulators, that's a problem. Yeah. If it's really no different than physical infrastructure like roads and bridges. You can roll the dice, but you might end up with issues. In Louisiana, which is the most recent state to vote on a ban on these so-called Zuckerbucks, that was late last year. They were the 27th state to do it. In Louisiana, I talked to a Republican clerk in deep red part of that state who said to me, we're keeping our 20-year-old election machines in metal warehouse with no air conditioning. No. And when something goes wrong, when there's extreme heat and something breaks or there's a part that needs to be replaced, we can't replace it. And we are essentially running on fumes. So they've gotten by so far, mostly. But I don't think it's a very sustainable plan.
And not with, you know, elections that are routinely underfunded, even in the best of cases. Now, your article at Bolt focuses largely on question two. That passed by an even larger margin on Tuesday. That question specifically asked if a state constitutional amendment shall be, quote, created to provide that only election officials designated by law may perform tasks in the conduct of primaries, elections, and referendums. Again, it sounds reasonable. When it comes to conducting elections in the state, only those designated by law to run elections should be doing so. But as you detail, there is much more behind this issue, and specifically the measure's vagueness, it seems to me, could wreak both havoc at the polls this year and, as you note, scare away some election and voting advocates from participating at all. What is question two really about? And then we can dive into a bit of its potential ramifications for November.
Well, I mentioned that Wisconsin is the 28th state to pass a policy like question one, which doesn't make it less interesting, but we know that terrain pretty well, and it's swept the nation. Question two is not something that we've seen voted on alongside these measures in these 27 other states. Mm-hmm. And like you said, and like we talked about with question one, it sounds pretty good. I mean, who wants a outside force with who knows what motivations coming into command election oversight and or administration at the local level. I don't think any reasonable person wants that. And it's easy to imagine when you read the plain language of the measure that this is going to stop, you know, some ill-intended foreign agent from coming in or who knows. In reality, this measure is inspired by an episode that played out in Green Bay, Wisconsin, in the 2020 election, when that city was extremely overwhelmed leading up to the 2020 cycle. They were dealing with the same pandemic issues that everybody else was. And by the admission of their own city officials, they were just nowhere near ready to run a smooth election. And so they accepted some of this outside money. They also accepted outside guidance from consultants who, according to an exhaustive report by the city attorney, didn't sway election results there, didn't do anything nefarious regarding juicing Democratic turnout or anything like that. They advised on how to run the election, on logistics issues. But nevertheless, Republicans have taken that and said these outside consultants from New York and wherever else were coming in and running Green Bay's election, and the state senator on the floor of the state Senate, as they were passing this measure onto the ballot, suggested, you know, because of that, we can't even trust the election results that came out of the city that year. There's no reason to believe that that's true, but that's where Republicans are coming from on this. It is a straight out of the big lie sort of deal. And in the absence of organized opposition to educate people on this, in the absence of much information from the media on this, it's easy to look at that measure and say, yeah, I don't want outside agents coming in and running elections.
And we'll get to some of these contractors and private groups in a second and how they help with elections. But you spoke to a lot of folks in your article at Bolt Magazine who are very concerned that this question in particular you know, this question could affect folks who help to ensure voters have things like specific ID that is now required to vote in the state, to, you know, election law and voting rights advocates who you report fear this may, quote, have a chilling effect on the many non-governmental groups and volunteers who assist in election administration. You begin your story focused on a guy named Nick Ramos, who has volunteered his time to help make sure that voters will have the ID that they need to vote. Tell me about him, what he does, and how Question 2 may now throw his role and others like him as volunteer election supporters into doubt.
He's a really good example. In Wisconsin, as photo ID laws stand today, and Republicans may yet look to change them again in the near future, but as they stand today, if you show up to a polling place and you are eligible to vote and you just don't have your ID with you, or you don't have that ID at all, but you mm-hmm. are eligible to obtain one, mm-hmm. you can literally on the spot go online and print out a paper version of that mm-hmm. that serves as a temporary ID for you and you can vote with it. This guy, Nick, would be basically on standby mm-hmm. in the Milwaukee area. And folks would call him and say, hey, we got somebody with this issue at this polling place. And he'd run over and spend a few minutes with them and they'd print out an ID and that person could vote. Nick is an example of the many, many, many kinds of folks who are not formally poll workers, who are not sworn in election officials, who do not work for local elections offices, but who assist in ways big and small in the administration of elections every single cycle. Mm-hmm. Those people, in many cases, may find themselves targeted by Question 2, which, again, is why this is sort of a wolf in sheep's clothing. It sounds good to say no foreign agents running our elections, nobody from the outside running our elections. But the fact is, lots of regular people who haven't taken oaths, who are not officials, who are not paid, yeah. help run elections. And so you'd mentioned that this chilling effect. That is one of the really big concerns here. Nick says it himself in my story. He said, look, if this thing passes, and now it has, I would be scared to do that again, because maybe now I'm running afoul of language that Wisconsin voters have placed in the state constitution. There's an almost unlimited number of people who could feel that way. And that is a real concern for the people who understand how Wisconsin elections actually run. It's these regular people like Nick who largely help to fuel them. And yeah. when I talk to experts, they're talking about everybody from the school employee who helps set up chairs in a polling place inside an elementary school, to the security guard, to the employee of a voting machine company who's on standby to troubleshoot. There's any number of people who might say, yeah, I don't want to touch this because I don't want to break the law.
And because it's so vague, they just refer to election tasks. I mean, what is an election task? Is Nick Ramos performing an election task by helping voters vote, by, you know, helping to print out their IDs? You spoke to a political science professor in Wisconsin who asked, what about helping disabled voters? Under state law, a disabled voter can have someone take them to the polling place and be with them when they vote. Well, would they be performing an election task and thus be blocked from doing so by Question 2 unless they're, I don't know, sworn in somehow by the election clerk? You also cite one longtime Wisconsin election law expert who asserts that the Question 2 will add, quote, substantial burdens and legal doubts onto the shoulders of hardworking local election administrators who faced with this new provision are going to see help that they previously relied upon fade away, are going to be facing substantial litigation risks, and are going to be unable to call upon expert advice and help from a variety of fields, including IT, security, ballot design. So this would seem to affect not just these volunteer, you know, the advocacy work, but the central operations of election officials and their ability to just run an election at all. How will election officials be affected here specifically by Question 2 and the ban on anyone but election officials designated by law from performing tasks? Is there a way to, are they going to just start swearing in any contractor who comes and helps them before they move those chairs and those tables around, as you describe?
I think something people should know about Wisconsin, and something that makes question two passing in that of all states particularly interesting, is that it's a state where elections operations are exceptionally decentralized. Mm-hmm. There are more than 1,800 different municipal clerks, mm-hmm. not to mention county clerks in every single county in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases of these nearly 2,000 local clerks that we're talking about in total, their communities are sometimes having hundreds or in the low thousands of voters. They may have one or two staff members. The number of quote unquote tasks that must be performed in relation to election administration for them, it's just not enough for them to do it on their own. It certainly wasn't enough in 2020 with pandemic stressors. And so, yeah, you might think, okay, with this new law, there's this loophole where, you know, they could get around it by simply swearing in as a poll worker anybody who does anything, including up to and including, you know, carrying a chair into a polling place in an elementary school. It's really not that simple, experts told me. There are specific rules around who can qualify as a designated by law election official. You can't just become a poll worker with the snap of your fingers. You need to undergo training. You need to meet certain residency requirements, not to mention age requirements. So when I say that this stuff is administered at the hyper local level, yeah. I'm talking, you know, families sitting around the dinner table helping, you know, the mom or dad who's the local clerk put stamps on absentee ballots. I talked to a guy who ran elections in a couple different small towns, and he said he was calling upon people who typically help clean and maintain park and recreation center bathrooms and facilities to help him get absentee ballots out. That's how local we're talking. And so the fear is a lot of those people aren't going to want to be involved. And a lot of the election officials who may have called upon them in the past will, in certain cases, say, I'm nervous to ask for that help anymore because who knows if I could get myself in trouble or the person I'm asking in trouble.
And, you know, election officials are not necessarily experts in things like computer programming or, you know, even important tasks like determining how many ballots are needed at each polling place or how much staff will be required. Often they turn to, you know, analysts, expert data analysts in these local offices, particularly in Wisconsin, as you know, where they don't run elections by county. They run it town by town, municipality by municipality. Ballot designs, even in states where they do run it by you know, counties, ballot designs are routinely contracted out for good or ill, but they're contracted out to private contractors, even voting machine companies who understand technically how to design the ballots that will work with the voting and the tabulation systems that are used in each jurisdiction. So does this mean those private contractors will no longer be able to work on elections? I mean, how will ballots be designed and programmed in this case? It might be a rhetorical question at this point with the answer nobody knows, but that's kind of the sense that I get here. They passed this constitutional amendment and nobody knows what the real ramifications will end up being.
I think that's right. I think that's why a number of folks I talked to said this is basically guaranteed to be settled in court. This amendment practically begs for lawsuits to be filed and for courts to weigh in, because there is so much vagueness baked into that word tasks, baked into the word conduct, as in perform tasks in the conduct of an election. It is so hard to say where that line exactly should be drawn that I think this is going to have to be settled in court. I have to agree with those experts. And if 2020 is any indication, I think we can definitely expect that Wisconsin's going to play host to any number of election lawsuits, just like every other swing state did and probably will again. So I think the passage of this measure kicks off many months of confusion, potentially chaos, of added stress for local election administrators, of added stress for the kinds of people who, like Nick Ramos, would be inclined to assist in local election administration. And the final word on what exactly question two even means is probably yet to come.
Especially, you know, in states like Wisconsin, where we saw among Republicans who would try to look back and find anything they could possibly regard as a violation of law and say, well, since they violated that particular law, we need to throw out all the results from this county or this state entirely. This just seems like a recipe for exactly that. Alex Burness, why was there no organized efforts by election and voting rights proponents or by the Democratic Party in Wisconsin to inform the public about these measures beforehand, to your knowledge? This just like quietly went on the ballot and nobody was paying attention to it until after it was already passed. Nobody, I should add, other than you, Alex Burness.
Well, I wasn't the only one who paid attention, but I was certainly one of few. I can't say exactly why this didn't get more attention, why folks didn't spend on it. I could dream up reasons, including fatigue, the general normalization of big lie politics, a perhaps understandable sense from those who'd be inclined to oppose questions one and two that, given the adoption of these measures in 27 other states, these things were probably going to pass anyway. So I'm not sure why. I think, again, this is something that if you're not squinting, as we did at Bolts, just sounds really good and looks nice, and you really can't imagine why anybody would oppose it. But it's the kind of thing that hopefully our publication exists to point out, like, you actually got to read the fine print, because this is something that could have a serious effect. And given that it's in one of the nation's major swing states, it's no exaggeration to say it's something that anybody anywhere who's interested in U.S. politics should probably care about. So the most generous thing I can say is that it was seriously underrated in importance.
We have you mentioned this at the top of our conversation, but, you know, Wisconsin, we have long been reporting on this show for years now, more than a decade at this point, you know, has long sort of served as a laboratory for some of the Republican Party's most autocratic tendencies. So I worry not just about the effect that this will have on Wisconsin's elections specifically this year, and thus the nation along with it, given the importance of the state to national elections. But as noted, question one, blocking private funding of elections has already been adopted by about 27 other states whose electoral votes went to Donald Trump in 2020. But have any of those states now, to your knowledge, either adopted or are considering adopting something like question two in Wisconsin? Because it seems like, boy, when something happens in Wisconsin, it gets, you know, spread to other Republican controlled states. Have you heard of that yet happening? And is there a concern that Wisconsin's great new GOP idea for messing with elections could now spread to other states?
Look, I think Wisconsin is clearly not the first state to put in restrictions on who can help around elections and to potentially criminalize what are otherwise routine activities related to elections. Georgia, for example, has gotten a lot of headlines recently for its water bottles and food ban for people waiting in voting lines. Mm-hmm. There is no other state, to my knowledge, that in tandem with the quote-unquote Zuckerbucks bans that have passed in these other 27 states, I don't know of any other state that has passed something like question two alongside of it. But the fear that you have that it could spread is certainly shared by lots of folks in Wisconsin, because states play copycat with each other on all sorts of things. And this is exactly the kind of thing that one could easily imagine popping up in another state. So it is totally possible that question two is not only interesting for what it means for Wisconsin and thus the nation, but what it could mean for any of a number of states in the years to come.
That's what I'm worried about. Boy, well, Alex Burness, thank you for trying at least to sound the alarm on this one. I will, of course, point folks to your important article on it at boltsmag.org. And the other important work that Bolts does that other outlets around the country are not doing, are not paying attention to, are not, as you say, reading the fine print to understand the real ramifications of this stuff. So thanks to you and Daniel out there at Bolt for trying at least to sound the alarm. Alex Burness, as I said, can be found at boltmag.org. You can also follow him on the site still known as Twitter at Alex_Burness. And Bolt's Mag is also the Twitter handle. Alex is a staff reporter at Bolt's Magazine. Alex, thanks for joining us. Hope to talk to you again soon, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hopefully it'll be better news next time we talk, but I doubt it.
Yeah,
that was everything
that's
going on this year. And what really concerns me about this is the vagary of that question, too. I think that's a feature, not a bug. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to allow them to cite that constitutional amendment for anything they don't like about what happens in Wisconsin this year. And again, as we were talking, other states, if they adopt similar measures.
Yeah, it's kind of a carry-all amendment that you can use for anything. And I guess we haven't mentioned lately that elections have consequences.
Yes, they do.
And you know that your vote really does matter because Republicans wouldn't try so hard to stop you from voting.
Yeah, indeed. By the way, as I was speaking with Alex there, breaking news coming in that the judge in Trump's hush money case in New York, that would be Judge Juan Merchan, has rejected his last-ditch attempt to delay the New York hush money trial with the presidential immunity defense. Basically, Trump is saying in the New York court they should wait until after the U.S. Supreme Court comes back with their decision on presidential immunity. I should remind you that the hush money payments that he made to porn star Stormy Daniel with whom he allegedly had an affair to hide that information from the voters back in 2016 to help him win the presidential election, that was all done before he became president. So to suggest that somehow he has presidential immunity for paying hush money before he even became the president, yes, he wrote more checks after he became president from the Oval Office to keep all of this quiet, but to suggest that somehow that was in the course of his duties as the president, I don't even think the Supreme Court would buy that crap.
Oh, with this Supreme Court, you never know.
You never know. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks again to Alex Burness and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download all of them for free anytime. Share them with anyone you know, love, or hate at bradblog.com. And hey, while you're there, please do consider hitting the donate button to make a contribution of anything you can afford one time, or even better yet, sign up for a subscription of any amount you can afford. That is the only thing that helps us stay on your public airwaves. So thank you. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you'll find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day over 1,000 auto workers at the Ford Assembly Plant in Kansas City, Missouri, began their occupation. The sit-down was the first strike by the UAW against Ford. UAW President Homer Martin vowed to organize the entire company. The strike had been called the previous evening when workers learned 350 of their co-workers had been laid off at the end of the day's shift. They demanded reinstatement, higher wages, better working conditions, and recognition of their union. The workers spent a good part of the early morning hours welding the gates shut to the railroad yards and parking lots surrounding the plant. Then they selected an 18-man committee to direct the strike. One leader, O.W. Penny, stated, quote, "When the company forced the strike on us by unfairly laying off men because of their union membership, some with 12 years on the job, everybody joined up with us. We signed 200 outside the plant, and they're signing others inside. Penny added, the pay here is not as good as at either Chevrolet or Chrysler plants. The boys there have better sanitary facilities and a cafeteria, while we have to eat our lunches sitting on the floor. Strikers lowered a banner from the top floor of the plant that read, Lincoln freed the slaves, Ford brought them back. Ford insisted he would never allow his plants to be organized, but company representatives spent the weekend negotiating a settlement with the UAW to rescind the layoffs. By Monday, April 5th, the workers were back on the line. Strike authorizations would flare up just 2 weeks later when Penny and another UAW organizer were beaten at the hands of company thugs. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.